This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Interacting with machines has become so routine that sometimes we barely even recognize we're doing it. Tell me if this sounds familiar.
Welcome to Directory Assistance. For a business government listing, please press 1 or stay on the line. For a residence listing, please press 2.
Hearing a computerized voice on the other side of the phone is so commonplace that we can forget there was once a person there. A person collecting a paycheck, paying taxes, paying a mortgage. Now, answering calls is often handled by a machine. Workers are always keeping an eye over their shoulders, wondering if the next technology could put them out of a job. And as we look back on the Great Recession, one of the central questions that economists are pondering intensely is this. Have average American workers computerized themselves into obsolescence? Professor David Otter, my guest today, has studied that very question and co-wrote a recent op-ed in the New York Times titled, How Technology Wrecks the Middle Class. He's a professor of economics at MIT, and he joins me now in the studio. David Otter, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And listeners, we want to know if you have seen your workplace changed by automation or by robotics, how the change has happened, what form it's taken, and if you've been put out of work by technology, or if you're worried that you might be. We also wonder what jobs feel secure to you and long-lasting to you in a world in which so many human workers are being replaced by machines. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. David Otter, I first want to talk about this sort of competing theory that in the past, there have been some economists in particular who have said that the number of jobs out there is finite. So the more jobs that get replaced by machines, the fewer total jobs there are for people. Now, there's also an argument that even when you lose some jobs, they turn in new jobs pop up in other areas. Machines create new technologies and services. So there are more jobs, there's just displacement. Which side of that camp are you on?
Very much the latter. So this is a very longstanding concern. The most widely known example is the Luddites, who were 19th century British weavers, and they were concerned about advances in power looms that they feared would displace their employment and devalue their skills. And they rioted, they smashed machines. And history has not been kind to them. Luddite is a kind of a derisive term for someone who fears technology. But the Luddites had a point. Although power looms didn't eliminate employment altogether. In fact, it created prosperity by making textiles less expensive, available to lower-income households and so on. It did devalue the skills of individuals who were artisan weavers. And so you can see both sides of this sword. On the one hand, technological change almost always raises productivity, that raises societal wealth. However, people who do have skills that are directly displaced or compete with that technology generally find their skills becoming less valuable. And so the point of our article is not actually that technology wrecks the middle class. That was
you were saying,
the New York Times sensationalized.
You were saying to me off air before we came on the air that you felt that needed some more nuance.
Yes. The point of our article was that it was neither all good nor all bad. It was actually – it created both benefits and challenges, and we're in a period where the challenges have become very salient because we see technologies changing so rapidly, and there's this sense of encroachment that I think has become more palpable as we kind of enter what many people perceive to be the kind of the PC era of robotics, when all of a sudden, you know, industrial robots, which have are outlandishly expensive and used in very limited applications, may all of a sudden be working in restaurants, may be, you know, picking fruit in fields, may be driving vehicles, right? The kind of iconic example being the Google car. And people, again, start asking the question, is this it? Is this the time when people are going to become obsolete? It's all going to be machines, and how will I make a living?
But you don't believe the number of jobs is finite. You do think they might just take a different form as a new product or service.
That has always been the case. There's no documented examples that I'm aware of, or that I've tried to become aware of them, of long-term technological unemployment. What we see very often is technology displacing workers from specific activities and tasks, and that's a temporary phenomenon. Over the longer term, we get new jobs, new services, people don't run out of ways to spend money.
Because so, as the technology industry, for example, expands, a bunch of new startups form that then take in some of those displaced
workers.
And
it's not even just in technology. It's just in leisure and services. You know, we have all kinds of entertainment and activities, you know, the software industry, healthcare, roadside motels, fast food, you know, celebrity dog walkers, all kinds of things that were inconceivable or wouldn't have been affordable. But because we've grown so much wealthier and so much more productive, we can do many more things. So at the turn of the 20th century, 38% of employment was in agriculture. At the turn of the 21st century, only 2% of employment in the U.S. was in agriculture. And that was because of technological improvements. The Green Revolution made us so much more productive. I think it would have been almost impossible for someone at the start of the 20th century to understand what those other 36% of the labor force would be doing. But they moved into manufacturing, and then they moved into healthcare and travel services and software. So in general, we don't tend to run out of wants. We don't tend to run out of ideas. And importantly, we have not run out of things that people can do that machines can't do. In fact, there's a very large set of things that people can do and machines can't do.
If we go back to that headline on your op-ed that you would have written differently, how technology wrecks the middle class, it is true, however, that it's the middle class in particular, or the types of jobs that middle class people often have, that seem particularly impacted by technological change. Tell us why that is.
Sure. So where we have been, information technology has been most effectively applied over the last 30 years has been in what some economists call routine codifiable tasks, activities that follow well understood rules and procedures, typing, filing, you know, sorting, calculating, retrieving information.
Things computers can easily
exactly.
do.
Exactly. Same for routine production processes.
Repetitive, not exactly. any high skills.
And many of these jobs, what I'm describing, are basically blue-collar production and white-collar office clerical work. And those have been, there's been extensive machine substitution. Now you could say, well, what isn't substituted? Well, on the one hand, you know, the natural example is, well, you say, oh, you know, managerial, professional, and technical jobs, what doctors do, what attorneys do, what designers and creative people do, these kind of abstract reasoning, creative tasks.
Those tend to be protected.
Those tend not to be substituted. In fact, they're arguably complemented. Computers make people more productive in those activities. But those are high educated jobs. The other set of activities in which computers have also not made substantial inroads are much more mundane activities like cooking food, sweeping floors, doing protective service, house care, personal care, many personal care activities like being a nurse's aide or doing, you know, acting as a coach or a trainer, even driving vehicles. We're actually further away from sort of, you know, eliminating people from cars than is popularly perceived.
But say changing a bed in a motel. That
exactly.
actually is something that's going to be fairly hard to get a computer or a machine
extremely
to do.
Hard. It'll be quite a while before that will be done robotically.
And that tends to be a low-wage job, which
and
is
And that's
protected.
The irony, right, is because those are not what we would call high-skilled tasks, but they're, from an engineering perspective, they're incredibly complex because they require this adaptability, this flexibility, sightedness, visual recognition, locomotion in a non-uniform space. And so people are good at these things, and at the moment, they're cost prohibitive to mechanize. However, the problem, the reason you say, well, why are they low-wage jobs then if people are good at them and machines are not? Well, the problem is most people are good at them. There's not a scarcity of people who can do those activities. So because the skills to do those things are not scarce, that means most people can be productive in those activities within a day or two of training. That means they're not going to tend to command high wages. So what computerization has done to a substantial extent is cause this what people sometimes call polarization, a kind of hollowing out of these middle education, middle wage jobs. It's not necessarily the same as middle class. And a growth on the one hand of these great jobs, you know, professional, technical, and managerial people with graduate degrees, you know, leading incredibly intellectually exciting lives. On the other, a growth of kind of mundane work. We see more adults doing what are thought of as teenage jobs, you know, doing food service, doing, you know, sales clerking at Walmart, doing cleaning. Fewer and fewer of those jobs are actually occupied by teens.
Which is its own negative trickle-down effect because there are
Absolutely.
Fewer jobs for teens.
That's right. So as is often the case, it's the least advantaged and least skilled who get walloped the most. So even though people are being displaced from middle education occupations, there's kind of a musical chairs phenomenon where they'll tend to move down and compete for those lower paid jobs. And so the first group to drop out is teenagers, right? They, you know, the median, the modal teen job now is an internship. Right. Unpaid.
You know, you also have talked about what you call a new artisan class. This is basically what you say may be the safe jobs. So tell us what that means.
Sure. So that term belongs to Lawrence Katz, a labor economist at Harvard University. And what he means and what we mean by that are jobs that virtuously combine a set of technical skills that are scarce with a set of interpersonal or flexible skills that are uniquely human. So jobs that might exemplify this would be a nurse or a nurse's aide, someone who's a plumber or an electrician, a skilled repair problem solver, an interior designer. These are people who have some skill that not everyone, knows off the top of their head, something that requires some in-depth technical training. But then to use that, you need to be able to interact and adapt flexibly in a way that's very difficult for machinery to do. It's clear that there'll be, lots of college-educated, post-college jobs. But when we say these new artisans, we're really thinking about, well, what will people who don't have four-year college degrees, are there good careers available? And I think the answer will be yes, but many of them will be skilled vocations that involve getting a two-year certificate, for example, or more to enter these activities.
I'm talking with MIT economics professor David Autor. He recently co-authored a New York Times op-ed headlined How Technology Wrecks the Middle Class. It had to do with how as some jobs are replaced by computers and robotics, those often tend to be the types of jobs right in the middle, not the very high end, not the very low end. And listeners, we want to know what you think about this. If you have found yourself affected by this, if you've lost a job, if you feel threatened, what you think the safe jobs are. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And David, we're getting a lot of calls, and I want to go to someone. This is Neil from Stoneham. And Neil, you work for Verizon?
Yes.
So what's your perspective on all this?
Well, you speak of being threatened. They came out with a wireless device now that they're going to be implementing that's going to be shipped to your house. You'll be able to get your TV service, your internet, and your phone all from this one device, and it'll all be wireless from this device to all your TVs and your computers, and they won't need us to run wire to your home. And there's a lot of technicians that do that right now.
And you see your job threatened as these possibly proliferate in people's homes?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
David Autor, let me turn to you. Is the job that Neil's describing, a technician for Verizon, does this fall in sort of the middle of what you...
Well, no. I mean, Neil raises a very interesting example. Obviously, it's a very personal example, and I can hear the real fear in what he's saying. And in truth, to undermine my own argument, I would have said, well, that's a job that requires a lot of, capability, flexibility, and so on. And that's true. To come and install wires at someone's house does require all those skills. But of course, if you can figure out a way to obviate the need for doing that, you can figure out a way to say, well, we'll just, we'll just beam it in from afar. So I think that that is a concern. And I think it's, I mean, that's a real, obviously that's a real case, a real salient issue for many people who are doing that type of work. And I think it's often the case in the fields that are technologically based themselves that you have the most rapid rate of change. I mean, this is true even for people who are computer programmers, that their skills can go out of date extremely rapidly. So after the year 2000 bug was quashed, sort of the need for COBOL programmers almost, came to an end. So I think that, hopefully someone like Neil who has technical understanding of the phone networks will find, will be able to be redeployed in other activities of telephone and communication support.
But would you say that it did seem that the job Neil does sound like it may fall in that artisan class, which we had hoped we'd be protected? It's unsettling to think it may actually not be.
I have to concede that is correct.
All right, I want to go to another caller. This is Evan calling from Newton. Hi, Evan, and tell us what you think about all of this.
Hi. So I work for a company that thrives on user-generated content online. And we've experienced a pretty big loss in jobs in the moderation of that content as we've begun to automate that moderation. But we've experienced a corresponding gain in jobs in the automation process, in the data monitoring process, all of those portions of the business.
So you've very much seen the type of shift that David Autor has been describing.
But let me ask Evan a question. Are the people who are doing the automation and the scripting of content handling the same people who did the actual moderation?
Do you mean are they handling the same user-generated content.
No, is it the same people?
Did they get the new jobs, basically?
No, not at all. The moderation of content is a relatively unskilled or uneducated position. It just requires a knowledge of English.
Right. So this is often the rub, that jobs are created and jobs are lost, but the new jobs are created don't necessarily employ the people that were displaced. So that's why, you know, it's easy to be too optimistic about technology to say, raises national wealth and so on. And that's true, but it doesn't raise every individual's wealth. And I think that's a case in point where you see they basically figure out how to script a task. They make it routine. And that displaces workers who specialize in that. And then, of course, you need experts to do the programming and manage that. That's a different set of skills. And in many cases, that requires a much higher level of training.
So two unsettling real-life examples in a row.
Well, I wouldn't have called the first one a new artisan job, but I'm going to count that one in my category.
So another caller, this is Miriam from Foxborough. And Miriam, you were about to raise, I think, an interesting point, which is where does the world of teachers fall in here?
Right. And also... assuming that many students are able to learn through online teaching, what happens to the students who need their teaching to be differentiated? Kids with dyslexia, kids with autism, are the special education teachers kind of safe because of the uniqueness of their teaching style?
No, I would hope not. In fact, I think that's exactly what makes education irreplaceable, is the ability to tailor, to work one-on-one, to inspire. You started off the question, said if most people can learn online remotely, the evidence is very much not so far that there's a perfectly good substitute for, face-to-face teaching. I very much hope our educational systems will manage to harness technology to kind of use more technology for some instruction and then more facilitated learning. We need to get more productive at education, especially if we want more people to go to college without the cost continuing to explode. I think special education is exactly a place where technology wouldn't be a good substitute. And hopefully, if school systems were actually able to conserve costs in other areas, there would be more resources available for those opportunities. So I do think teaching will be affected. I think sort of at the college level, for example, we'll see kind of more super teachers who, put out lecture series and so on, and then more facilitators who work one-on-one with students to help them rather than each professor needing to be a kind of inspirational speaker per se. But I don't think we will eliminate people altogether or anything like it from education.
I want to take another caller because so many are coming in and many people are raising good points. And this is Jeff calling from Sandwich. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. So my comment is just that I know that as we kind of move into this technological economy and more technological society, some of those jobs fall by the wayside and some more jobs are created. But I wonder if in the long view, if this isn't similar to the change that occurred when we moved from an agrarian society to an industrial society, where as that adjustment happens over time, people find new niches and new jobs and, creativity is happening, and that in the long run, that the technology actually creates kind of a new middle class that doesn't rely so much on the building of cars or baseball mitts, but on other, technologies or industries that we can't even imagine are going to happen yet.
So it feels cataclysmic, but in fact, there may be victims, but in fact, it will sort of self-correct.
Yeah, Jeff, I think you put that very well. I mean, we've really gone through two big technological revolutions the last century. One was from agrarian to industrial. The other was from much more manufacturing-based to much more service-based. And in general, that's right. We haven't run out of jobs or anything like it, and we've created all kinds of new activities that we didn't foresee. But I will say one thing that has allowed us to make those transitions successfully is our sustained century-long investments in people, in education, human capital. If you imagine the workforce of the turn of the 20th century, being plopped down in the U.S. right now, most of them wouldn't find work because they would be illiterate and innumerate. So We have adapted to these changes partly by continuing to invest in our own skills. And even the turn-of-century farmers understood that their kids would be moving out of farming. They didn't know what to. And that was part of the reason that got the high school movement going in the United States that caused us to be the first country to universally send our population through high school and really was a key to American prosperity in the 20th century. So I agree with you that there will be new activities and new types of work, but we do need to prepare ourselves for them.
I'm talking with David Autor. He's an economics professor at MIT. He co-authored a recent New York Times op-ed called How Technology Wrecks the Middle Class. And David, so talk to us more about what we can do to prepare for this. What are your recommendations for how people don't become a victim of this?
Yeah, well, at the you know, I think the place to start, of course, is in the school system and in improving, you know, primary and secondary education. I don't think it needs to be radically changed, throw the book out, et cetera. I think actually the fundamental human skills that will continue to be valuable are analytical skills, abilities to communicate clearly, to write, to reason, to be creative. But we need to do it. We need to up our game there. We need to send more adults to college. But on top of that, I think we need to help people make appropriate vocational investments. It's actually, if you're a kid on the sort of college track in high school, you have a very simple agenda, right? I want to do well in high school. Why? Because I want to go to college. What college do I want to go to? The best one I can get into. What should I do once I go to college? I'll figure that out when I'm there. It's actually, you know, you can postpone the decision and still follow the right trajectory. If you're not going to a four-year college, you need to think, well, what can I do with my high school degree? It's not a particularly employable degree right now. I need something else. Should I learn a trade? Should I become a medical paraprofessional? Gee, if I'm going to do that, should I go to community college or should I go to a for-profit college? That's more expensive, but I can get through it faster. I can get into it sooner. And I think that landscape of is much more treacherous and much more unfamiliar than the kind of college track that many are trying to pursue. So I think we could do much more to help young people make appropriate career investments. And instead of saying, well, you didn't get to college, so we're done with you, say, well, how can we help people, even while in high school, figure out the types of careers that they can choose that are skilled, that have potential, but don't necessarily need 16-plus years of education.
And what about older people who are long through with school and they find themselves out of a job or threatened with losing a job?
I think that's an ongoing challenge. You know, we have a, quote, trade adjustment program in the United States that allows people impacted by international competition to get assistance of some forms. It's not as generous or flexible as it could be. But I don't think we should be distinguishing between trade adjustment versus technology adjustment. Why don't we just call it adjustment? If I lose my job because a worker in China is doing it, or I lose my job because a machine, you know, just installed in my building is doing it, I'm still out of work and I still need new skills. So many other countries do more in terms of so-called active labor market programs to help people reintegrate into the workforce. And that's something the U.S. could improve at.
Retraining, re-education. Don't just keep futilely applying for the same type of job you were in previously.
That's one way to do it. Also, you know, some countries and some places use what's called wage insurance, where if someone has to move from a higher wage to a lower wage job, the government helps them meet some of the difference for a while. So, you know, eases that transition, and then perhaps they'll bounce back into a higher wage job as well. One reason people don't take new work when they lose a job is because they're holding out for the same job again. Maybe they're holding out for the same high wage again. That may not always be feasible.
So be a little more realistic. Could we really simplify it and say, think really hard about what job is out there that a robot could not do or is unlikely to be able to do, and then maybe you'll be safe?
I think it's instead of thinking about the jobs, I try to think more flexibly about the skills, right? The sort of, you know, the sort of things that use those human traits of flexibility, adaptability, empathy, intuition, creativity, problem solving, and then things that are complemented by that, right? So, you know, I think being in the medical field is a good example. Lots of technical skills, but also lots of people skills are incredibly central. So I tend not to think from the robot side. I tend to try to think from the human scarcity side. But
David Autor, we found a little piece of newsreel that I want to play. It's from 1946, and it's basically kind of touting the advancements of automation at home with machines like toaster ovens.
Yes, Rollo the robot, the chromium-plated butler, is just a daydream after all. But not so Rollo's little brother and sister robots, the millions of small mechanical servants that never ask for afternoons off, the amazing machines and gadgets that almost seem to think for themselves.
So So we tend to be very excited about new things. Everybody wants the Roomba, the little self-cleaning vacuum cleaner. So, of course, it's this kind of, you know, we on one hand, we celebrate these advances. On the other hand, they're taking away some of our jobs. How do we reconcile these things?
We all benefit from these advances, right? We all benefit from, from even a vacuum cleaner is a great advance relative to a broom and mop. Technology always has its flavor of displacing. But again, the concern about running out of work, that has a long history. So a 1974 government report from the Department of the Interior warned, leisure, thought by many to be the epitome of paradise, may well become the most perplexing problem of the future. And the concern that there just wouldn't be work to do. And the Nobel-winning economist Herb Simon at the same time, or actually a few years earlier, wrote, the world's problems in this generation and the next are problems of scarcity, not of intolerable abundance. The bogeyman of automation consumes worrying capacity that should be better saved for real-world problems like population, poverty, the bomb, and our own neuroses.
I want to bring in one last caller, and this is Phoebe calling from Medford. And Phoebe, I think you're going to try to sort of wrap this all up for us.
Great.
Hi, yes. So I think that one of the reasons that this question of how technology benefits and detriments people is so difficult is because it's more of a philosophical question about how things can benefit people's lives in small ways, like kitchen appliances, but then they may take away in bigger ways, for example, taking jobs away from people who are in the middle. You know, we all gain from things like Netflix, entertainment, but and people in the higher level professions like technology may benefit, but then others are detracted from. So ultimately, some people benefit, you know, others are taken away. It's a utilitarian question.
Right. It's that question. What does technology add? What does it take away?
Well, let me say, I think what that points out is not that we don't have that we have a prosperity problem, but an income distribution problem. Mm-hmm. Technology is creating lots of prosperity. The question is, how broadly is it shared?
That sounds like another segment that we could spend another half hour talking about, and maybe we will down the line.
Thanks for the questions.
I've been talking with David Autor. He's professor of economics at MIT. He recently co-authored an op-ed for the New York Times titled How Technology Wrecks the Middle Class. You can find a link at our website, radioboston.org. Professor Autor, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks very much. It was a pleasure.
And stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk with a Tony Award-winning director of a new musical adaptation of The Jungle Book. It opens this weekend at the Huntington. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.